This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Big news, as you no doubt heard, out of the Supreme Court today as SCOTUS strikes down the Defense of Marriage Act. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be getting your reaction and discussing what this might mean for Vermont couples. You can feel free to let us know how you're feeling now. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net, or you can join us on our Facebook page and post your reaction there. But today on the program, we're going to talk about another issue that's important to Vermont and fairly unavoidable at the moment with all the rain we've been experiencing, runoff that gets into our watershed. We think about it a lot in summer because we start to experience algae blooms and we spend more time swimming and enjoying our waterways. Nutrients that cause pollution in our water are still spilling into the water at alarming rates. It's something the state and other organizations have spent a lot of time trying to combat, and we're going to look at how those efforts have been going and why this seems to be such an intractable problem. We're joined today by Carrie Dolan, Vermont's Ecosystem Restoration Program Manager, and Suzanne Levine, UVM Professor of Water Resources. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the nutrients that are both good and bad for our waterways. And so we really have a sense of why we care about how much phosphorus is in the water, why we care about nitrogen and other things that are getting into our watersheds, and why the level actually matters. So let's talk about phosphorus first. What's so bad, first of all, about algae blooms? That seems to be what everybody worries about. We get these algae blooms. What's wrong with algae?
Well, there are a number of problems with algae. Well, there's a good aspect to them, too. Of course, they're the basis of the food web in aquatic systems, and the zooplankton, the small, you know, plankton that live in the lake depend on them for as a food source, and then the fish depend on the zooplankton. But if there's a lot of phosphorus, there's plenty of nutrient for those algae to grow. It's sort of like adding fertilizer to your garden to get the vegetables to grow more.
And 1 pound of phosphorus can feed, what, 300 to 500 pounds of algae? Is that right?
About, yeah.
So it's like super fertilizer for algae.
Yes, it's super fertilizer. And the algae also need nitrogen to grow. And so we do need to worry about both nutrients, but often it's the phosphorus that's in shortest supply. So, you know, if you add so much phosphorus, you get a multiplication of that in the algae formation. Now, the problem with the algae, the biggest problem is that when they die and settle to the bottom and decompose, that the decomposition uses up oxygen. And so if you have a lake that is stratified, that's existing in layers that don't mix, the bottom layer can become anoxic, depleted of oxygen, and you can lose fish and other organisms.
Now, in talking about algae, most algae is actually not toxic to humans. I mean, we can talk about how it affects animals, but not toxic to humans. But blue-green algae is one that we do worry about, toxic to humans, toxic to pets. Carrie Dolan, what's the problem with blue-green algae and phosphorus?
Well, I think you mentioned right from the get-go that it's a public health concern, especially when we rely on our surface waters to recreate, to swim. We, in many places, including Burlington, we rely on Lake Champlain for our drinking water source. And so when you have these types of algae blooms, which are indicative of this poor water quality or enrichment of the lake itself, there are obviously some public health and safety concerns.
And blue-green algae also fed by phosphorus.
Correct.
And unpredictable, as far as I can tell. We always worry, are we going to see the blue-green algae and where are we going to see it? But it doesn't ever seem to be clear at the start of the season where we're going to be seeing any of these algae blooms.
Well, fortunately, we have a very effective monitoring program in partnership with the Lake Champlain Committee, with the University of Vermont, with the Department of Health, as well as our own agency, the Agency of Natural Resources, to work with citizen watchdogs to help identify where those algae blooms are occurring. They can occur throughout the year. Principally, we see most of the significant algae blooms and the concerns because that's when we like to cool off in the summers. And those are obviously the time of the year when we're most concerned about the algae blooms. But we are trying our best to try to at least monitor and record where the algae blooms are occurring. We can't be everywhere at all places, but having the citizen monitors available and interested in participating in this monitoring process is helping us identify the locations of where they are, and that helps us to articulate to the public about potential concerns.
Suzanne Levine, I want to go back to something that you had said a moment ago. You mentioned about phosphorus, that it is, of course, an essential building block. It's necessary for life, and algae isn't bad in and of itself. If phosphorus is so necessary a nutrient, how do we know what level is appropriate versus what level is too much?
I think what you need to do is decide how much algal biomass you want to have.
So it's all about the algae.
Yes, yes. And yeah, so if you want to have enough to support a good fishery, say, but not so much that you get the blue-green algae present creating the toxins. And the other problem with the cyanobacteria or blue-green algae is that they are able to regulate their buoyancy. That is, they have little flotation devices that they can inflate, which allow them to go to the surface, and they form those scums that you see that look like green paint on the water. And then they can deflate them and go back down, get down to where the sediment is, and get any phosphorus they need, come back up to the light. So that's one reason why the cyanobacteria or blue greens do so well late in the summer when the nutrients are running out in the water and they're able to go down and get nutrient. Yeah.
And do we know? Yes, go ahead, Carrie Dolan.
Well, I just want to mention we are talking about algae in lakes because we are water flows downstream, and we live in watersheds where what we do on the landscape affects our own backyards and our downstream neighbors. And it is in our state, the lakes that receive a significant amount of that runoff eventually that contain the nutrient loadings that we're concerned about. But when we talk about, it's important for us to step back and recognize that these algae blooms are a reflection of water quality conditions for the lakes themselves, but the impacts actually stem from what we do on the landscape upstream and the water quality of our backyard streams and our neighboring streams are equally as important because we know they can contribute some of that loading to the ultimate place of Lake Champlain. So clean water, I think, is the heart of what we should be talking about because we are focused on what we can do to help our own to address water quality needs across Vermont.
Well, and we are talking about that today. Our number, listeners, if you have questions about phosphorus runoff, nitrogen, and what we're doing on our landscape that contributes to water quality problems, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. But Carrie Dolan, we've been focusing on phosphorus and runoff and ag runoff and parking lot runoff for, 30 or 40 years now, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. Why not?
Well, first of all, I think we have made some significant progress. We've prioritized where our dollars should go, and we've had a shared responsibility with using state and federal dollars to address what we call point source discharges of the nutrient pollution into receiving waters. Point sources are the discharges from factories or from wastewater treatment plants, and we can regulate those discharges to help control the amount of nutrients. And we've made tremendous progress since the 70s by putting in a significant amount of resources to reduce the nutrient loadings from those point sources. Unfortunately, the progress we've made has been somewhat overwhelmed by the magnitude of a problem associated with runoff. And what we refer to that as non-point sources. And that's where the challenge is because they're diffuse in nature. There are little problems scattered across the landscape. And really, there's no silver bullet. There's no one source of the problem. It's basically all of us and how we use our landscape, the farmers and the ag fields and the production areas, the municipal streets and parking lots, our gravel roads and road networks that are adjacent to our streams. Our rooftop runoff that's connected to the town street systems. how we use our timber stands and how we manage access, road access into our timber stands. So basically, you're not making many friends when you tackle the non-point source or the runoff problem. And I think that's probably where the greatest challenge is that the public is demanding clean water, and we're struggling to determine how to best meet that demand.
And the water itself, when we measure phosphorus loads and nitrogen loads and other things in it, even when you've controlled things like wastewater treatment, point source pollution, are you still not seeing a lessening of phosphorus in places like Lake Champlain where it's pretty heavily monitored?
What we have found is that the loadings of phosphorus are somewhat a function of the amount of precipitation we receive. And I tell you, it's pretty frustrating when we see the every day this week and last week, the threat of flash flooding anywhere in the state and the contributions of flash flooding to channel instability or delivery of nutrient pollution, sediment pollution on receiving waters is of a concern. And but there was a recent study by the U.S. Geological Survey who looked the researcher looked at the concentrations of phosphorus and tried to normalize those data by eliminating or removing the variability of stream flow, and found, in fact, we are making progress in the amount of actions we've taken to address polluted runoff across all these sources I mentioned. The problem is with a lot of stream flow, you tend to overall get a trend towards greater delivery, greater loadings of nutrient pollution into our receiving water. So we still have the challenge of being smarter in what we do, how we implement those programs, and where we implement those programs.
One of the big issues, of course, is fertilizer, which contains a lot of phosphorus and a lot of nitrogen, and that's a huge part of where some of this pollution comes from. And I wanted to ask you, Suzanne Levine, because I read this somewhere that even if we were to completely stop using all fertilizer, which is not realistic, but if we could just completely eliminate our use of fertilizer, our use of phosphorus and nitrogen, just the amounts that are still in the ground would take decades to dissipate, right? So regardless of what we do now, you know, as Carrie Dolan is saying, it's going to be a delayed reaction in terms of getting our water quality back to where we would like it to be. Is that right?
Yes, in part anyway. And my interest in eutrophication has been more at a global level, looking at what's happened to the global phosphorus and nitrogen cycles.
And eutrophication, that's when
eutrophication is when nutrients allow algae to expand in biomass. And what has happened is that to support agriculture, to support this green revolution that we had starting about 1960, that we've had to add nitrogen and phosphorus fertilizer to our crops. And we not only add this fertilizer to cropland, but we also add it as a supplement to animal feeds. So, for example, the dairy industry will add phosphate to the feed for lactating cows because they want to make sure there's enough phosphorus to produce milk. And the problem is that the nutrients have been added too generously, and they've built up in the soils. And so the issue is that if the soil is eroded, then it can work its way into the lake. The soil actually holds on to phosphorus pretty well. However, if you keep adding it, it will eventually saturate. And after that, any new addition, that nutrient will just wash into the lake. So we have to be very careful about not saturating the soils and then retaining those soils that are contaminated.
You mentioned dairy, and we got a note from Andrew who says, I boycott Vermont dairy because my children swim in Lake Champlain. Yes, Wisconsin cows pollute the water, but my children don't swim in Wisconsin. I'd like Vermont dairy farms to go the way of the Vermont sheep ranch of the 1850s, that is, turn into forest. Do you think that's a reasonable response from Andrew? I mean, should we just get rid of dairy and then the problem solved?
Well, I think we need to work with dairy. And looking at it at one scale, the problem is partly that we've consolidated our operations. If we had a lot of them that were small, spread out, then we wouldn't have so much manure saturating soil. You know, people use manure as a fertilizer, and it can be useful in that way. But if you have a lot of manure and you don't want to go too far to deposit it, you'll just add too much to one place, and then you do saturate the soil. So one thing we could do is figure out other uses for the manure so it doesn't get to the water. Or we can try to better adjust how much fertilizer and how much feed we use, maybe use less phosphorus supplement in the feeds. There are a lot of different things that could be done. And I guess how I would feel personally is I'd like to pay more for the dairy products and be more careful about the nutrients. You know, that's one thing the public can do. They can take on this burden, help the farmers to do a better job.
Carrie Dolan?
I want to add that I guess I would categorize the non-point source problem and the runoff problem into four general categories, agriculture being one of them. But we also have road-related runoff. We have stormwater in developed landscapes. And we have unstable streams that all contribute or have some part of the runoff contributes to the problem. And
but agricultural production makes up the highest concentration.
Well, it depends on where you are in Lake Champlain. In some places that are very rural and where they have high concentrations of farms, such as in Franklin County, yes, you could argue that, and the data show that the agricultural sources are probably make up the lion's share of the sources of nutrient loadings. But in other places in the lake, especially around Burlington, for example, would be more of an urban setting that would be contributing the lion's share of the source. So it does depend on where you are. On the whole, if you look at the Vermont side of the lake, it's typically split between, they say, more or less 50-50 between urban and agricultural sources. But we've had recent information to show that in-stream unstable streams are actually contributing upwards of 35 to maybe even 40% of the problem in those localized areas. And the point I want to make in mentioning that is that what's new now is that farmers, municipalities, our sister agencies and transportation are all recognizing that they want to be part of the solution. We're trying to move away from just pointing our fingers at one source, recognizing to be comprehensive and recognize the contributions of all these sources. It's important that we have these conversations to try to address the reductions across these categories.
But is the state in a tricky position, in a sense, because the state does want to support Vermont dairy. That's been very clear in Vermont agriculture. The state does want to support economic development, which often includes roads, includes parking lots, does want to support, you know, landowners wanting to come to Vermont, wanting to buy a house here, and yet you're also trying to control this. So does that put the state in a difficult position in trying to encourage certain things that also, if you encourage those, tend to encourage pollution?
Well, no, I would argue that we're being much smarter in what we need to do. We've recognized over the course of the last 20 years or so that when you, in fact, target your limited dollars to what I would call hotspots, areas in the landscape that would be causing and contributing a significant amount of nutrient pollution, some call it critical sources of phosphorus loadings, you can improve your cost effectiveness threefold. In the past, we used to say we would need to do everything, everywhere, eventually, the three E's. And now we recognize that we don't necessarily need to do that. We can be smarter if we can target our dollars to where we need to make those reductions. And I think by doing so, we can make a difference. And now the agricultural community is very much engaged in being part of the solution, as well as the other sources as well.
We're going to talk in just a couple of minutes about some of those targeted solutions, where those targets are, what we're aiming for. We're also going to hear from some of you. You have questions as well and thoughts on reducing pollution in our waterways. I want to make sure that we're talking here not just about Lake Champlain. We also want to keep in mind Lake Memphremagog, the Connecticut River, lots of other water sources that people are concerned about in the state. And if you have questions, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, I'm talking with Carrie Dolan, Vermont's Ecosystem Restoration Program Manager, and Suzanne Levine, a UVM Professor of Water Resources. And we're discussing unwanted nutrients or unwanted levels of nutrients in our waterways. Listeners, if you have questions about phosphorus runoff or other things like that, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211, or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Chris, who's waiting on the line from Jeffersonville. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Hey, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to point out I'm here in the Lamoille Valley, and, as with all of our major drainages, the Lamoille, the Winooski, the Missisquoi, the White, they all are just loaded. The banks of those rivers are loaded with farmland. And whereas the comment was made that all farmers are getting on board to make this problem kind of, to fix this problem of our phosphorus load, I would disagree with that. We have some farmers that are certainly on board, and they are increasing their vegetative buffers along their banks to filter out these harmful nutrients. But if you drive along those rivers, you'll see there's a lot of places where we have corn spread right up to the banks of the river. And when they're spreading manure on that corn, where do you think the manure is ending up? I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Chris, thanks for your call. Appreciate that. And I want to just add to Chris's comment before we get a response, because it's not just farmland that we're talking about right here, right edging up to the waterways. We talked on this program several months ago about a riparian buffer zone and a shoreline protection bill that was moving through the legislature. It didn't pass. But we got a note from Janet on this show about that. And Janet says, the Agency of Natural Resources is trying to push through a bill called Shoreline Protection. This is sweeping legislation that restricts landowner rights and, as far as I can tell, does not even address the sources of pollution. What are your thoughts on the bill's ability to actually affect water quality? So let's take Chris's comment and Janet's comment here about what should our responsibilities be for landowners who have land right up on that waterway in terms of making sure that we have a buffer, if that's what's going to prevent the runoff that we've been talking about as such a problem. Carrie Dolan, we'll go to you first.
Well, first of all, I believe it was Chris that talked about, I didn't mean to characterize that all farmers are on board, but we have begun the conversation with the agricultural community. Last year, we had 25 separate kitchen table meetings with the farming community to talk about the need to address polluted runoff and what we can do, what we need to do. Farmers still need the technical assistance, educational assistance, financial assistance to get the job done.
What is it you want them to do?
Well, there are a number of what we call best management practices or actions they can take to reduce runoff. And there's a whole suite of different actions that range from livestock exclusion, keeping the cows out of the stream, especially in areas that have perhaps an eroding bank, cover cropping to ensure that the soils are not exposed throughout the year at any one period of time. There's a whole suite of actions they can take depending on what the problem is that we're trying to solve. As a follow-up to those meetings, we've organized what's called an agricultural working group. It's 25 members. Most of them are farmers or at least of agricultural service providers. And that interest is to identify specific actions that they would like to see statewide within the agricultural community. And what we'll need to do as a follow-up is to take that on the road, meet with farmers, talk about what we need to do, and provide the resources that the UVM Extension needs or that our Agency of Agriculture needs to get the job done, to provide or deliver the technical and financial assistance. Keep in mind that the demand in the agriculture community for funding to assist them in addressing these water quality challenges is much greater than the supply that we have available. And yet these conversations we're having is showing that farmers are interested in being part of the solution.
But why aren't those regulations being put into place and made into law now? I mean, similarly to the Shoreline Protection Bill, that didn't pass. Why, if this is such a priority, why are we not passing regular? And I don't mean to pick on the farmers here, because I realize, as you said, there's a lot of different non-point source pollution. But why aren't we making more laws if this is such a priority?
Well, first we have to recognize we do have, I think, four categories of statute that support water quality at the farm, both in the farm field as well as in the production areas. We have, for medium-sized farms, we have regulations associated with how they want to and should be managing their soils. We have large farm regulations. We have what's called accepted agricultural practices that provide sort of low-cost actions farmers can take. And now is what we should – I'd like to mention is this new phosphorus cleanup plan that EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and in conjunction with the state of Vermont, is identifying the steps we need to take to address these sources. And so there is the existing regulations. The obvious question is, are they being enforced? Is there compliance? Those questions require resources. And that's part of the discussion. Everything is on the table. And it may, in fact, require a combination of regulation and more technical assistance, but all those options are on the table. And farmers are now willing and are organizing themselves to have those conversations.
We got a note from Kirsten who says, larger farms do not pollute more than smaller farms. Although they produce more manure than a small farm, they also have more land on which to spread it. In fact, those larger farms are required to follow more stringent environmental regulations like nutrient management plans, increased buffer widths, and many more. Most farms in Vermont are trying really hard to be good stewards. And let's go to Bob calling in from Walden. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
An excellent program, and I'm always glad to listen in. I disagree with Ms. Donnellan on many aspects. I know that she's working hard on this problem, as have many people over the last 30 years, but I think the obvious question has not really been addressed, and that is the lack of political will to confront the interest groups that keep us from changing these so-called best management practices into actual laws, as you mentioned just a minute ago. I've witnessed loggers going right down to stream beds, taking trees out. I've witnessed, especially up in Franklin County, but it could be any place in Vermont, as Chris mentioned, farming right up to the river or streams.
Hey, Bob, I want to take your point and give it to Suzanne Levine here, because she's not a politician. She's a professor. And Suzanne, I don't know if you have tenure or water, you know, how comfortable
you are.
Yeah,
I do. But
good. So I want you to be really honest here. You know, here's Bob saying, look, I get that people are working hard on this, but we need more regulation. And I'm still – Bob says, I'm seeing these things. I'm seeing things that we know are not best practices. So where's the political will? And from your perspective, as a water resources professor and expert, what do we do?
Well, I think it's been frustrating for those of us who work on water management, the fact that the Clean Water Act, even state legislation – routinely exempts agriculture and civiculture, you know, from
civiculture meaning the rest of us?
Forestry from regulation. And it's partly because, you know, we were a rural nation to start with, and we very much value our agriculture. And we don't like the idea of seeing it regulated. But in agriculture has industrialized to a certain extent, you know, at least nationally, internationally, and they are more like an industry, and maybe they do need more regulation. That's from someone who's just giving their own opinion. But the other thing that concerns me that I think we need to think about is bookkeeping. Bookkeeping as far as what nutrient is coming into the Lake Champlain watershed versus what is going out. And we've been in the last few decades in this sort of watershed model where we look at what happens within the watershed and how it affects the lake, but we don't look at what is coming across the boundaries of the watershed. And we're bringing in nutrient, a lot of it is, as fertilizer, as animal feed, as human food. And instead of exporting all that nutrient that we bring in, a lot of it gets stored in the soils or goes into the lake. And that's stored in the soils can eventually go into the lake. So, Yeah, that just was the problem you brought up earlier about this legacy that we have to deal with.
Well, there's certainly much more to do in terms of monitoring, in terms of evaluation, in terms of regulation, and we could certainly talk about this for hours. We have done many shows on this. But Carrie Dolan, I want to ask you one point, too, as well, because we haven't gotten into this much. But in 2011, the EPA revoked the pollution plan for Lake Champlain, and we're still waiting for the EPA to come up with a new plan, and then the state has to decide how to regulate and enforce it. Do you have a timeline on that?
Yes, in fact, we actually see that effort that EPA took of revoking the approval of that restoration plan as an opportunity, because we are now working very closely with EPA and our both federal and sister state agencies to put together a plan on what that plan is going to look like. And that will have all the elements that the callers have been mentioning. It will talk about the greater regulation. It will talk about greater need to deliver technical and financial and educational assistance to all these sources. And it's really going to require a shared responsibility to actually implement those actions that will be identified in that plan.
And do we know when it's coming?
Pieces are coming out this August, September. We'll have some public hearings and stakeholder meetings across the state and across the basin. Like, keep in mind, Menford Magog and Connecticut River is right behind this whole TMDL process for Lake Champlain. So wherever you stand in the state of Vermont, we're dealing with clean water needs, and the agency is there to help shepherd that forward.
Good. And we'll keep an eye on this. You can keep us posted as well. Carrie Dolan is Vermont's Ecosystem Restoration Program Manager. Suzanne Levine is a UVM Professor of Water Resources. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Coming up, progress in HIV/AIDS treatment and prevention in Vermont. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This week marks both National HIV Testing Day and the 25th anniversary of the Vermont HIV/AIDS Comprehensive Care Clinics. Since the 1980s, there have been many improvements in the treatment of HIV and AIDS, but obstacles do still remain. Dr. Christopher Grace founded the Comprehensive Care Clinics. He joins us now. Dr. Grace, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
And we're also joined by Deborah Kutzko, a nurse practitioner at Fletcher Allen who specializes in HIV/AIDS treatment. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit first, since it is the 25th anniversary, and we're going back in time here now to the 1980s when HIV was such a new disease. Dr. Grace, how did you come to the decision, get the backing, decide that it was time and we needed to found these comprehensive care clinics?
Well, early on, we were seeing, you know, an increasing number of patients coming into the clinic in Burlington, but we also were seeing a large number of people coming from all over the state, people driving 3, 4, 5 hours. And as that number of people started increasing, we recognized that the barriers to getting care were just too much and that something had to be done to bring specialty HIV care to the entire state.
And there are now 4 comprehensive care clinics. There's the one at Fletcher Allen in Burlington. There's one in Rutland, St. Johnsbury, and Brattleboro?
Correct.
I have them right. Okay. And what do they do on a daily basis? Why do we need these care clinics, rather? I mean, they're all based at hospitals. Why is it something that needs to be separate?
Well, the reason to have them in the hospitals is so that they will blend into the background of the infrastructure of the hospital. But you need people. There's a nurse practitioner, a nurse, and social worker at each clinic. And you need those resources reasonably close so that if people do have problems, they can go into those clinics, you know, on very short notice. And versus, say, I get sick and I need to drive 3 hours. It's just not going to work. And even for more simple things, having the local care there is vitally important.
Deborah Kutzko, can you talk a little bit about the kind of care that you deliver and what that care looks like today?
It looks much different than it used to. Today, most of our patients are on medications that keep them healthy. I think for a fair amount of our patients, social stigma is still very present and very real, which is why we have social workers in every clinic. People have problems with housing. People have problems with substance abuse, employment. And for those folks, our social workers are invaluable. On a day-to-day basis, most people do fine. They go to work. They go to school. Much different than it was 25 years ago.
Were you working in this field 25 years ago?
I was. I was the AIDS program director for the health department.
So it must feel tremendously different to you now.
It's tremendously different. We were just talking about the many, many people who died in the old days and who died particularly bad deaths, some of them, of diseases that we hadn't seen in medicine forever. And again, the social stigma was very hard.
Dr. Grace, when someone comes into the comprehensive care clinic who's just found out that they have a diagnosis of HIV, what do you tell them? I mean, what's the sort of message from healthcare professionals now about what life is going to be like?
Well, we first tell them that this is a serious infection, but we can deal with it. We have excellent medications, and indeed, most of our patients are being fully treated with one pill once a day. Most people tolerate these medicines very well now, in contrast to the old days, and that if they can take their medicines on a very regular basis, the expectation is that they will feel well and have a full life, and that psychologically, that's what they should prep for.
How many people in Vermont have a diagnosis of HIV or AIDS?
Well, I can tell you that in our clinic program, we follow about, I'm guessing now, about 450 people now actively, and the Department of Health estimates there's probably about another 100 people out there that are infected but unknown. They haven't been tested yet.
That seems like such a small number in a good way. 450 mm-hmm. to 550 Vermonters with a diagnosis seems really good in some ways, but I'm sure it's also very isolating to be a small population and to still, as you said, Deborah Kutzko, have that social stigma that comes along with a diagnosis. But does that small number in Vermont mean that we don't pay enough attention?
I think that's absolutely true. And the fact that the health department estimates there are 100 people out there, Vermonters, who have HIV and don't know it, mean that they're not getting tested, that their primary care doctors aren't bringing it up. You know, the Centers for Disease Control suggests that everybody between 16 and 64 get tested for HIV. I don't think we do a very good job of that. One of the ways we've been trying to work about that is that we have a website called Get Tested Vermont that will let people know where they can get tested.
There are new regulations or new practices that are coming in as well, though, aren't there, for doctors to test people more regularly for HIV, make it part of more routine testing so that it's less of a thing where you have to say as a patient, I am going to go to a special clinic and get this test. It's more of a regular test that people might get for an annual visit, women might get, for example, when they go see their gynecologist. Is that changing things?
Again, the Centers for Disease Control says everybody between 16 and 64. We used to talk about risk groups, and you only needed to get tested if you had sex with men or you had sex with multiple partners or used drugs. And clearly, we didn't find those people. I think there is still a lot of reluctance in Vermont. Somehow, we think the Green Mountains protect us, and we don't have to worry about it. But clearly, everyone should be tested.
Dr. Grace, you mentioned that if you have a diagnosis of HIV now, today, it's not a death sentence, but you do still have to take medicine every day, and that medicine is very expensive. What are the barriers in terms of cost for treatment?
The medicine is very expensive, but compared to other serious chronic illnesses, it's on par with those. The barriers are financial, but I must say that between the state of Vermont and the federal government through what's called Ryan White Care Funding, there is money to support people getting these medicines. And quite frankly, if you're in Vermont and you have HIV, you can get these medicines.
So what do you see then as the biggest challenges moving forward in the treatment and prevention of HIV and AIDS?
Well, and those are now linked. Despite all the work that has been going on for decades about prevention, there are still 50,000 people being newly diagnosed in the United States every year. So the illness is not going away. And I think the most important thing is that people do get tested through their primary care docs, and that if they are found to be positive, we can treat them and make them better, and they can live a full life. And the other benefit of that is that those people who are treated and we drive their virus down, the transmission essentially goes away. So it's not only a treatment strategy, but it is a public health strategy.
Deborah Kutzko, your thoughts on that?
I agree. I think that people need to get tested. And again, I think the stigma is out there still that you don't want to bring it up because then your doctor will think you're doing bad things, and the doctor doesn't want to bring it up because, you know, that might embarrass the patient. The reality is this is an infectious disease just like any other. We don't get squeamish about testing people for measles. People need to be tested, and we're very happy to help them out once they get their test.
That's Deborah Kutzko, an infectious disease nurse practitioner who specializes in HIV/AIDS treatment. We've also been talking with Dr. Christopher Grace, a professor of medicine at UVM and the founder of the Vermont HIV/AIDS Comprehensive Care Clinics. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Last weekend, ham radio operators took part in a national event called Field Days, which highlights the importance of amateur radio. In Rutland, the Green Mountain Wireless Society set up ham radio stations at the high school football stadium and broadcast for 24 hours, calling out to other stations all over the country. Tim Abraham, vice president of the society, was one of the participants.
I must have spoken with about 30 or 40 stations. I was in charge of a special station that was for non-licensed visitors. So I was helping visitors train on the radios, and the public had an opportunity to learn about amateur radio at Field Day.
You had the Boy Scouts come, didn't you?
We sure did.
What did they think of ham radio?
They thought it was pretty cool, and we had certificates for each of them as they contacted a station. If they contacted another station, we gave them a certificate, and so they were happy about the hobby.
You were making these calls all night long, all day and all night, 24 hours?
Yes, from 2 p.m. on Saturday until 2 p.m. on Sunday. We contact as many other amateur radio stations as we can. It's really an amazing event because we come together on the weekend in a public space where there's no communications equipment. And by the time Saturday rolls around, we've set up six operating positions and erected six antennas and four PCs and tested out our radios and gathered food and supplies and tested out our emergency power generator. And Field Day is also a contest. It's
right.
A contest to see how many points you can get based on the number of radio stations you have and based on the number of contacts that you made. So we total that up and send it in to the people who figure out who won the contest.
And do you know yet who won the contest?
No, we don't know yet. There are Field Day setups from all over the country, so it takes some time to gather all the data and come up with the winners.
Well, when you talk about setting up this temporary equipment and you set up in the football field, you do this all in a couple of hours to get set up, you have supplies. Part of the reason for that is because this is a drill to make sure that amateur radio enthusiasts are really prepared to help out in an emergency. How would ham operators help in an emergency?
Well, in the case, for example, of Hurricane Irene, we have a emergency communications room at the Red Cross, and we were up and running very quickly into the hurricane. We're able to send and receive messages that are really clear and concise. For example, we would be in contact from the Red Cross Center to the Red Cross shelter over at Rutland School. And so that's one way that we communicate. We also communicate with the animal shelter for people who have stranded animals during Irene.
In the days of the internet, you know, leaving the emergency situation aside, where the internet probably doesn't work for many people, how do you get people still interested in ham radio when they've got all of these other devices at their fingertips? And if they want to chat with people around the world, you've got chat roulette, you've got other ways to get in touch with people. Why should anybody pick up a ham radio?
Probably the most valuable experience is the electronics skills that you learn as you take the exams to become an amateur radio operator. We have good communication skills and learn a lot about electronics, and we conduct a ham radio course every fall.
Tim Abraham is vice president of the Green Mountain Wireless Society. He participated in an international event called Field Days last weekend, which highlights the importance of amateur radio and emergency preparedness. Tim, thanks for talking to us, and will you let us know how your team did when the results are tabulated?
I sure will. Thank you very much for having me on.
All right, and that will wrap us up for today's show. Now, tomorrow on the program, your reaction to the Supreme Court ruling on the Defense of Marriage Act. Vermont put itself at the center of this debate more than a decade ago with the civil union law. And since then, same-sex couples in Vermont have had to follow two different rule books, federal law and state law. We'll talk about the legal and social change the court signaled by striking down DOMA, and you can tell us how you reacted to the ruling and what you think this might mean for Vermont. Post your comments on our Facebook page, where we're already hearing from many of you. Barbara says she's feeling overwhelming joy and gratitude to the Vermonters who played pivotal roles in the long fight to get here. You can add your own thoughts. Go to Facebook.com, find Vermont Edition. You can also send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in for that discussion tomorrow. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistants from Tim Johnson and Annie Pruitt. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.